the dark days are done and the bright days are here. My sunny one shines so sincere. Sunny one so true. I love you.
Our next guest is one of those rare talents who has something to say and can say it funny. He's a writer-performer on the new Laugh-In and one of the most popular, outspoken, and entertaining personalities on the local news here in Los Angeles. He's won a half a dozen Emmys as a film critic and host of his own shows. Let's welcome Mr. John Barber, right over there.
Thank you. This is John Barber. Welcome to John Barber's World. That was Sarita singing Sunny and Frank Sinatra introducing me the night he took over for Johnny Carson as host of the Tonight Show. It's September 5th. It's Labor Day, a day that decades ago meant something to America.
Mm-hmm.
When America had unions and Americans had jobs. Today, it's about as useless as Bruce Jenner's jockey shorts, except it's a day off, you know, and I'm sure a lot of you aren't aware of this, but it gets much less press attention each year than does National Pickle Day or National Donut Day. And I think the only way that we can ever retain this as a legitimate holiday is to dedicate Labor Day only to expectant mothers. And speaking of mothers, once in a while I go into Target here in Las Vegas, and it is filled with young mothers with bunches of kids. There are a lot of Mormons and Catholics in this town, and they go into Target with a bunch of kids, and the women have these holler tops, and they're still very attractive. But what is so discouraging to me is to see these attractive ladies who have these skimpy halter tops on, and their skin is covered with tattoos that look like bruises. It is beyond me why they do that. You know, and I always thought, gee, I wish I was a cartoonist, because if I were a cartoonist, I would draw this. I would draw this guy absolutely covered in tattoos, sitting in the tattoo artist chair, and the artist is saying to him, "What would you like this time?" And the guy is saying, "Something that looks like skin." Today, my friend told me that the Clintons and the Bushes are getting together for a Labor Day barbecue, and whenever they get together, they hug and sing, "This land is my land, this land is your land." I have this wonderfully warped Republican friend named Dennis in Indiana, and he's not sure for whom he's going to vote this year. Excuse me if I offended you by using correct English by saying for whom. Anyway, because I said when Americans had jobs. Oh, my goodness gracious. I got to tell you something here in a second. Anyway, he sent me this great, great poster of the duo that he would love to see as president and vice president of the United States. And it was Wiener Holder. Oh, God. Sometimes I think I have to entertain myself. You know, I live in Las Vegas, which is the gambling Vatican in the world, and where you'd think there'd be a lot of inexpensive comedy clubs. Well, there are not. So I often, in trying to entertain myself, I often do this. Well, I don't often do it, but it's about once a month, just before 9 o'clock in the morning at that time of the month when I need to get some money, just before the bank is open, and there's a crowd waiting to get into the bank, and the ATM machine is right next to it. I go to the ATM machine and put in my card, and when the money comes out, I holler, "I won! I won! I won!" But that's not nearly as bad as one of my golfing buddies. I have a golfing buddy, black guy, veteran of the LAPD for about 40 years, And he has the most deliciously warped sense of humor. And every once in a while, he'll go into a Walgreens drugstore, and if there's nobody around the counter, and it's an attractive girl, he will walk up to her, and he will ask where the condoms are. And once he points it out, he stares at her a second and says, "And where's the fitting room?" And then he says, if he gets a big laugh, he often has a date for the night. Well, anyway, football season has started. That's America's major move into bread and circuses, a sport I no longer watch, folks, since that fraudulent Super Bowl about a year ago. But on this Labor Day, in the last couple of days, especially the other night, a lot of Americans were upset because this guy, Kaepernick, I believe his name is.
He's a quarterback.
That's right. That's right. He's a quarterback for the 49ers. Well, he refuses to stand for the anthem, saying that this is a country that disregards folks of color. Well, it also disregards intellectuals. It also disregards people looking for work. Now, as you probably know, and I do, I know dozens of people who say out loud they can't stand fake wars, they can't stand the fake candidates, they can't stand the fake newscasters. So if that's true, and they really feel that way, they could not stand for the anthem along with Kaepernick. Now, first of all, the national anthem was never played at a football game, even during World War II. It was introduced long after the war, long after the Cold War, as a matter of fact, because the Pentagon had to pay the National Football League to play it, to get all us folks pumped up patriotically for all these fake wars. Musically, the Star Spangled Banner is shock and awe. It is an absolutely dreadful tune with warmongering lyrics. I mean, get that, the rocket's red glare, the bombs bursting in air. If they're gonna have an anthem, it should be something maybe like, it should be maybe like America the Beautiful, which would be so much better because it's about the land. It's amber waves of grain and purple waves of majesty. But you wanna know something? If there were really an anthem, you know what I would like it to be? I don't like the anthem at a sporting event, especially a football game, because it interferes with the coin toss. But you know what? If I were to have an anthem, you could not beat The Land I Live In, and sung only by Frank Sinatra. I'm just going to play you 20 seconds of that, and you'll know why this should be the national anthem. So hang on just a second here, and I will play this for you. Here we go. Right. I hope it comes through on the mic. Here we go.
Children in the playground, the faces that I see, all races and religion, that's America to me.
And that's America to me. It's about people, you know? And this is the only country in the world that is made up of every other country in the world. Okay, so that would be my choice. I love people, and one of the people that I love having back, this is the second time she's been back. She was wonderful. She was here a couple of months ago, and she is wonderfully articulate, has a great sense of humor, is absolutely and totally outspoken. She's a professor of philosophy, teaches philosophy at the University of San Francisco. And she was here a couple of months ago talking about a really shockingly interesting book called American Nuremberg, about officials in this country who should be tried for war crimes. And she's making this Labor Day a holiday for me by coming back today. Her name, Rebecca Gordon. Rebecca, thank you for coming back to the show. Are you in San Francisco now?
I am in San Francisco now, and this is a city with a magnificent labor history. A lot of people don't know, but back in 1934, the city of San Francisco was on a general strike. The workers shut the entire city down for days. And even going back further into the days of World War I, when there was a lot of resistance to the war here in San Francisco, and they actually put some of the labor leaders in jail, they did a trumped up basically a terrorist attack on a patriotic march, and used it as an excuse to put a couple of the main labor leaders in this country and this city on into jail. So we are proud celebrators of Labor Day here. And I always tell my students, you know, I often ask them, so why do you think we have weekends? And they'll say, well, you know, you work, and then the days at the end of the week, that's your weekend. I say, yeah, and why do you think you don't work on the weekend? Do you think that the factory owners decided, oh, you know, people have been working so hard, we should give them the day off? No, people fought and died for that. They fought and died for the eight-hour day and your overtime pay. And I try to help my students understand that the things that we take for granted in terms of working, if we're lucky enough, as you say, to have jobs, are not things that were just given to people, but things that people fought and died for. And, you know, Labor Day, the reason we have it now instead of when the rest of the world celebrates Labor Day, which is on May Day at the beginning of May, but we have it our own time because it was established basically as a kiss-off almost to organized labor and as an alternative to the day when most people in the world celebrated the International Workers' Day, which is May 1st. Nonetheless, I'm always happy to have a three-day weekend and will take it whenever you give it to me.
Well, the wonderful thing about your students having you as a teacher is that your students probably have parents and have grandparents who, if they have a job, get to work 8 hours a day. Mm-hmm. And in many cases, the grandparents might be getting Social Security.
That's right.
And if these kids aren't forced to go to work when they're 13 and 14 and they don't have to work until they're much older, they can be very thankful for not only the labor unions, but a lot of these programs, they are descendants of Norman Thomas's socialist mm-hmm. platform in the 1920s and the early teens. And people are shocked to hear that Social Security didn't start with Republicans who were trying to end it and privatize it. And it didn't even really start with FDR implemented Social Security to save capitalism, for crying out loud, because mm-hmm. there were 30 million people unemployed. All of these programs came from Norman Thomas. And during the early days that you just mentioned in San Francisco, wasn't Jack London a large part of that?
Yes, he was. He was definitely part of the intellectual left in San Francisco and left, you know, and then later on, of course, we had the Beat Generation, who were not so much politically involved, but some of their descendants are. I have to tell you, my mom worked for Norman Thomas in his electoral campaign.
Oh my goodness gracious.
Yep. So she actually worked for him, and when he was running in the same election as FDR, and she was a labor organizer too. She was a union organizer in New York City and Washington D.C. for the Amalgamated Clothing Workers of the United States, which is now part of the Unite Here mega union. But she organized laundry workers and factory workers in southern factories in Tennessee. She also was lucky enough to spend a couple of months driving Eleanor Roosevelt around the southern United States at one point during World War II. So yeah, I come by my left-wing inclinations quite honestly.
Well, that's astonishing. You know, you also are the city that housed one of the most interesting, outspoken, colorful labor leaders that I had ever heard of. And I happened to meet him in the early 60s. My second professional job as a stand-up comic was at your famous Hungry Eye.
Ah.
Ah. I loved the place. I loved it. It was the only club I was ever in where there were actual theater seats and people sat. Like, it wasn't like other clubs I worked where there were round tables
and everybody's talking. And
this was, it was like you were in a little theater. Anyway, I met the fellow in the lobby, introduced to him by my wife, Sarita, and Enrico Banducci, who owned the place. Enrico with his favorite Tam. Anyway, it was Harry Bridges.
Harry Bridges. Yep.
Amazing. And he was always being attacked by the mainstream media and always seemed to survive and come out on top.
Absolutely. And, you know, the longshore workers continued their political work all the way through the 60s, the 70s, the 80s. In 1990, they actually held up and prevented South African ships from unloading in the ports in Oakland and San Francisco as a campaign against apartheid. So
they also blockaded a lot of armaments that were being sent out of the ports to Vietnam.
That's right. Absolutely. Out of the Concord Naval Weapons Base.
Well, yep. Okay. Since we talked about Kaepernick and we talked about San Francisco and its leftist liberal tradition, how are people in San Francisco responding to Kaepernick's stance or non-stance when it comes to the national anthem?
Well, it's really interesting. I have been pleased to see that for the most part, after the first sort of knee-jerk, oh, what's wrong with him, spoiled brat sort of response, a lot of people have actually supported what he has to say. You know, here in San Francisco, we have a really serious problem with racism in our police force. And we know this because a lot of the texts and email messages that they send each other have actually been leaked to the press. And the stuff that these police say to each other about people of color is really pretty disgusting. And in the last 2 years, we have had 5 people of color who were unarmed, who have been shot by the police. And
there was a recent movie. It's about 2 years old, about a cop that shot a guy in Oakland. I forget what the name of the movie is, but it's a wonderful film.
Yeah, Fruitvale Station. The man's name was Oscar Grant, and the cop who shot him wasn't really even a policeman. He was the BART. He was the BART police. The BART is our Bay Area Rapid Transit. It's our metro, underground metro system. And it was on New Year's Eve. And he was shot. And the excuse that the man who shot him gave was that he thought he was pulling his taser out of his belt. And instead he pulled out his gun and shot him with the gun.
And the penalty was like 6 months or
no
penalty at all?
No, he went to jail. He did go to jail, but he went for involuntary manslaughter, not for anything worse than that.
And how much time did he serve?
I don't honestly know. But you know, the folks who, the man, we had one case, a guy named Mario Woods, and this was last year. You can still find the video on YouTube if you want to see it. It's just awful. This man was lame. They shot him in the leg. He's up against a wall, and he's surrounded by a semicircle of police. And you see him just kind of sidling along the wall, trying to get away. And they just shot him down like a firing squad.
And
nobody has been held to account for that. Nobody has been held to account for the death of a man named Amilcar Lopez Perez, who was a Guatemalan immigrant, who was his family's sole support back in Guatemala. He was walking down the street in my neighborhood in the Mission with his own bicycle. 2 undercover cops decided that he was a bicycle thief and started running after him. He didn't speak any English. Not only did he not speak English, he hardly spoke any Spanish because he was a Guatemalan Indian from Guatemala, not a Spanish speaker. And we're not even sure if they even identified themselves as police. And they shot him 6 times in the back. It took 6 months to get the coroner, the medical examiner, to release the report of the autopsy. And in the meantime, his family ordered, or not his family because they couldn't afford it, but we collected money, including my little church, collected money to pay for a private autopsy because we were afraid that this was all going to be hushed up because they claimed that he ran at them with a knife. Well, it's pretty hard to shoot someone six times in the back, including in the back of the head, when he's running at you with a knife.
Oh, that is just horrifying. Tell me a little bit about your students. Do these subjects come up? You're teaching philosophy.
Well,
is there such a thing as philosophy anymore?
Yes, there is, actually. And, you know, the school that I teach at is a Jesuit school. And the Jesuits are very concerned about philosophy and always have been. And the other thing that's interesting about the Jesuits is there are kind of two wings. So there are the right-wing Opus Dei Jesuits.
Yes. Yes.
And then there are the left-wing Jesuits. For example, Pope Francis is a Jesuit. He's our first Jesuit pope. And these are the folks. So our president up until the last year or so, he's now resigned, a guy named Stephen Privet, was a great friend of the six Jesuits who were liberation theologians who were murdered by the Salvadoran death squads in El Salvador. So at my school, everybody has to pass a semester of ethics and a semester of service learning in order to graduate from the school. And so, yes, and you have to take a regular philosophy class as well, in addition to the ethics class. So, yeah, we still teach philosophy.
Rebecca, 20 years ago, the narrowest, the smallest issue that Time magazine ever issued, and I have a copy of it, was one headline called Ethics.
I was to advertise in that issue.
Yeah, nobody, that's funny, advertise. Oh, now, when these kids that are there, you say sort of the left and the right of the Jesuits, I was surprised to, one, my favorite magazine back in the, I had two favorite magazines. One was The Realist, Paul Krasner's Realist, and the other was Ramparts.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons I loved Ramparts, they were only one of three periodicals in America that supported Jim Garrison's investigation into the murder of John Kennedy. And I was stunned when I found out it was put together by Jesuits.
You know, they get a bad rap, but the Jesuits have a real commitment to thinking deeply about things and truly a real commitment to social justice. So you ask about my students, and they are a fascinating bunch. So one-third of the freshman class for the last 2 years have been first-generation college goers. So the first generation in their families to go to college. And that means that you have to provide a fair amount of scholarship money because these are not people whose families come have a lot of money, obviously. About half my students are young people of color. We have a number of about 15% of the students are from other countries, primarily actually from the People's Republic of China. And that's really interesting because they are coming into a world that is completely different from the world that they grew up in. And then I ask them to go and work in community-based organizations in, you know, some of the poorer parts of the city and to learn about issues that you really probably don't learn about even in the U.S. press, let alone in the Chinese press. So, and I sometimes wonder what it would be like to go to another country to do college work, and then you already don't understand that country very well. You barely speak the language, and then be asked to go out and try to understand the deep social problems of that country. I mean, I myself would find it fascinating. I think some of my students just find it a little bit bewildering.
What is the average age of your students, Rebecca?
Okay, so most of them are 18 through 22, 23. But then I have a layer of students who are in their late 20s or early 30s who are people who've been out in the working world for a while and are paying for school themselves. And a lot of them are working full-time while they're going to school. And the funny thing is, they are the most organized. They are the ones who always get their work done on time because they have so much work they have to do between schoolwork and work for pay. And I've had a number of veterans when I first started teaching 12 years ago, I had a lot of students who had family members or friends or boyfriends or girlfriends who were fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan. Now I'm starting to get the veterans. And some of them are some really messed up young people. I mean, they're good people, but they have been through hell. And I had one student a few years ago, one of the best students I ever had, who was in Iraq, and he lived in Baghdad, actually in a house in a neighborhood where he was going out and doing patrols in the neighborhood. And I mean, every time he left the house, he didn't know if he was going to come back alive or not. And what he said to me is, look, if anybody who's been fight in Iraq tells you that they came back whole, they came back all right, they're either lying or they haven't figured it out yet. He said, every one of us is damaged in some way.
Did you ask this young man if he ever killed someone?
I had another student. I did ask him, and he had. It's hard. You don't, you know, you want to be careful because I don't want to overstep my bounds as a professor, you know, and take advantage of the fact that I have a certain amount of authority to ask people questions that they have a right not to want to answer. But I had another student last spring, who had been an Army sniper, and he served 5 years as a sniper, both in Afghanistan and in Iraq. And he had also been in a Humvee that was blown up by one of these improvised explosive devices. So he had a broken back, and he had so much PTSD from the combination of what he had done and what happened to him, that he had to sit in the very back of the class, and most of the time he had to leave before the class was over because he just couldn't stand being in a room that was enclosed with that many people in it. It was just too much for him.
Well, and it's astonishing that he would even attend the class.
Yeah. Well, you know, and it's interesting, he was an autodidact. He was somebody who had not gone to college before he went into the military. He did his 5 years in the military, and then he started teaching himself history by reading. And by the time he got to my class, he had, let's just say, a very jaundiced view of the wars that he had been part of.
It must be thrilling for you in some respects to teach people like that. When you look at, I just saw a clip. I'm putting together a documentary about the media and the second assassination of John Kennedy, and I came across this wonderful soundbite from John Lennon, and he says, "I think we are ruled by lunatics." Mm. And it was a wonderful, revealing interview. Mm-hmm. Anyway, you look at the people who rule us, these lunatics, and you're probably enormously discouraged because you see they rule us, and yet you have a class mm-hmm. full of kids 18 to 22 who don't want to be lunatics. It must be inspiring.
It is. It's really, you know, I learn stuff from them every single day. It keeps me young. And I also am amazed by how open they are to learning both their history and their family's histories and to really wanting to, I mean, a lot of them are very goal focused, and what they want is to get a degree so that they can get a job, so that they can buy a house, so that they can live, you know, the good, you know, the American dream. But it's amazing how many of them want their lives to mean more than that and to be more than that. And the other thing I'll say about them is, even when they don't know very much about the world, and even when they are, you know, a little bit a little bit naive about the world, they are so kind and gentle with each other. And this is something that I really respect. Because, you know, in an ethics class, you talk about what you believe, right? And if you're not careful, you're going to be calling each other murderers. If you ever talk about something like abortion, for example, I'll end up having half my class call the other half murderers without even knowing they're doing it. And yet they are so respectful of each other that it is actually a lovely thing. The other thing I want to say about them is this year I have students who were 3 and 4 years old, 2 years old, on September 11th, 2001. So I am now getting the generation of people whose lives were not formed by September 11th, whose lives were not sort of focused on that day as the thing that fundamentally changed the world. They grew up after September 11th. And so they have a very different picture of the world, I think, than the students I had 5 or 6 years ago.
It's ancient history to them. Now you mentioned mostly men, young men. How about the young women in your classes? Are there any?
Well, in fact, there are more. It's interesting. We're about 60-40 women and men at USF. And in colleges all over the country, the average is about 55-45. There are more women in college than men nowadays, which is interesting, and I don't know what all the reasons for that are. But the young women are very interesting. For one thing, absolutely all of them are as convinced as the young men that they will have to work their whole lives. They have no idea, no picture at all of the life of the 1950s, where you had one breadwinner who went out and earned the money and the woman stayed home and did the work at home and did the child care. They have no picture like that at all. They are all absolutely convinced that when it comes to supporting themselves, they are on their own.
Well, you know, the astonishing thing, even though 2 years ago I said that Bernie Sanders was going to be the Democrats' Ron Paul, the astonishing thing that I think surprised the nation and surprised especially Bernie Sanders and especially the media. You know, when in the 40s, when I was growing up, all the people that mattered to me, all our entertainers and all our society, all our entertainment, they were all adults. I mean, yep. Sinatra was a young adult, Bing Crosby. But after the Beatles, it was all children. And we've since become a child or youth-oriented society. And I sort of forgot what I was going to say. Oh, yeah, about Bernie Sanders, is that 90% of all the people who followed him were under 25.
I know. It's amazing, isn't it?
There were millions of them, and I think it frightened them. It was like the time, there was a time in the 60s when it looked like New York City was going to explode. There were about 20,000 people out on the street. It might have been right after the murder of Martin Luther King, mm-hmm. and they were going to have to call in the National Guard and the Army. And Malcolm X said, let me speak to them. Mm-hmm. And he got that crowd to go home.
Yep.
And
yep.
it was either the lieutenant governor or one of the somebody in high office in New York said, no nigger should have that much power.
Ugh,
within yep. law, and within a yep. short time, he was gone. And so was Martin Luther. When you're with your students, do you ever talk about people like John Kennedy or Robert Kennedy or Cesar Chavez or Martin Luther?
Oh, sure. I especially talk about Cesar Chavez a lot, because we oftentimes talk about questions of justice and issues that have to do with how much people should get paid for the work they do. And, you know, my students start out saying, well, a doctor should, you know, get paid so much more than somebody who picks food, right? Because think of all the skills that they have. And so then I say, okay, how many of you went to the doctor today? And maybe one person will raise their hand. And then I say, how many of you ate something today?
That is so wonderful. That is, the truth is, you know what? I, even as a kid, I always said, because I had no parents and I was swayed or influenced by a couple of really bright teachers that sparkled my mind, right? That that you, as a teacher, are almost having more contact with the child than the parent.
Yeah.
And I think that teachers should be paid as high as police, as high as lawyers, as high as politicians, because they are such a major factor in a child's life, but unfortunately they're not.
No.
So for you people to sacrifice income in order to do what you do, it's just wonderful.
Well, you know, it's also, it feeds me. It makes me, like I say, it keeps me young. It makes me feel like, in a small little retail way, I'm doing some good in the world. I'm giving students some tools to help them think about the world that they're encountering out there. And, you know, every once in a while I get to derail a business major and turn them into something else, and that'll make me good.
Well, Rebecca, thank you again so much. And you're going to come back again in about 6 or 8 weeks, if you don't mind, because I have the most wonderful story to tell you about Cesar Chavez and
how he saved
my job in television. I don't have that right now, but I want you to tell folks where you can get that fabulous book, American Nuremberg, and where they can read your stuff.
So you can read my stuff pretty much every 6 weeks. I have a new piece on TomDispatch.com. So my latest piece is about the war hawks who wrote that, the 50 guys from the national security world who wrote that Donald Trump doesn't have the moral character to be president. And I looked at who some of them were and wrote an article about who's talking here. So TomDispatch.com. I have my own website, which is called MainstreamingTorture.org. And because that was my first book, was called Mainstreaming Torture, or my first recent book. And then the book itself, American Nuremberg, you can get at any local independent bookstore, of course online at Amazon and Barnes & Noble. There's also an Audible version, which I recorded myself. So if you would like to hear my voice reading the book, and there are electronic versions available if you don't want to buy a hardcover book. So it's available pretty much everywhere.
Rebecca, thank you. Rebecca of Sunnybrook School, thank you so much. You're an absolute delight. You're a treasure. We'll talk to you again in about 6 or 8 weeks. Thank you so much for being here. We'll be right back with another great voice, Joe Satilli. Hi, this is John Barber of John Barber's World, every other Monday at 5 p.m. Pacific right here on VBS Radio. I'm telling you about a terrific show, The New Criminal Minds, with outstanding actor Gary Sinise, called Criminal Minds Beyond Borders. A tough drama about a special unit of the FBI involved in protecting Americans who are beyond borders. It follows the regular Criminal Minds, airing every Wednesday at 10 p.m. Eastern, 9 Central. Don't miss it. Gary Sinise is outstanding.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
Thank you for that smile upon your face. Oh, sunny.
Hi, this is John Barber. You may remember me as the co-host, producer, and creator of Real People, America's first reality show. Or most recently as the writer-director of what's been called the definitive documentary on JFK's murder, The Last Word on the Assassination. Now I'm doing a show every other Monday from 5 to 6 Pacific Time on BBS. You'll hear provocative views, unreported news, and film reviews from me, with outstanding guests and you. Join me on John Barber's World.
Hi, I'm Richard Belzer. This is the great BBS Radio.
Those of you who have an ongoing interest in the JFK assassination might want to know about this. TV producer John Barber. He put together a dream team of JFK researchers, including Coast regular Jim Mars and world-class JFK writers Dick Russell and Joan Mellon. They all got together at UNLV in front of a live audience. They had a screening of Barber's terrific, and I'd say historic, film based on interviews with prosecutor Jim Garrison of New Orleans. And then after the film was shown, the experts all talked about the latest JFK theories and evidence. It's now out on a DVD. Terrific stuff. I'm George Knack, Coast to Coast AM.
Welcome back to John Barber's World. I'd like to thank George Knapp again for that wonderful unsolicited review of The Last Word on the Assassination, which you can see up there on Amazon and all the proceeds to that. And thank you all. It's selling wonderfully, and I don't know why and how, because it's all underground. It's sort of like guerrilla television is what it is. But all the monies from that are going into part two of the American media and the second assassination of John Kennedy, which we have started editing this week and hope to have done in about 6 or 8 weeks. It will be a mind blower, believe me. Hopefully the Woodstock of documentaries are making a major contribution to that, and the major contribution to your awareness, if you're interested at all in anything that's going on in the world, your awareness if you read his brilliant newsletter called News Vandal. It is by far the best and the most objective in the country, and I couldn't do this show anymore without him. My cord, Joe Satilli. Joe, thank you so much for being here again.
As ever, John, my pleasure. And it's, you know, it's an amazing pleasure and an honor to listen to Rebecca Gordon, who is just seems to have a wellspring of energy and insights.
Wouldn't you have loved to have had teachers like that?
Well, I did get lucky. My primary mentor as an undergraduate, it was a former Jesuit. And, you know, Rebecca is in a Jesuit institution, and the Jesuits do seem to have cornered the market on excellence in education.
Well, one of my very favorite quotes, and you've heard me say this, I think, a couple of times. Of course, my favorite two writers in the world, I have three, but my favorite would be William Shakespeare, would be Mark Twain. And then, of course, the greatest book about show business I ever read by Ben Heck. One of the great quotes I have up on my wall is in 1970, at the height of the Vietnam War, the build-up to the Vietnam War, I had this nun on. Her name was Sister Carita, and she had written this small book, almost a pamphlet, and it was called To Believe in God. And I thought, gee, she'd make an interesting guest. Now, you know, I'm not religious, but I love great minds, and this lady had a great mind. So she came on, and she was a huge hit, took calls from people. But the middle page opened it up, and it said, to believe in God is to have the deep, abiding faith that somewhere, someone is not stupid.
Well, you're more likely to believe in God than American democracy.
So there you go. Anyway, quickly, during the break, we were talking about, you're talking about Rebecca and how terrific she is, full of energy and ideas and compassion. And there aren't people like that in, you know, we used to see them all the time in early television, because when early television started, they needed to sell the boxes. In order to get people to buy the boxes, they had to put something in the boxes. Now, the first thing they did is they go to burlesque and they go to radio, because these are proven performers. And then once they're used up, then they go to a Bishop Fulton Sheehan or Alistair Cook or somebody can talk and give them shows. You don't see that anymore. You don't see any of that on television show. So indeed, it's a thrill. But speaking of what we won't see during the break, you were talking about, you mentioned the passing of Phyllis Schlafly.
Yes, Phyllis Schlafly has died.
Whose body died 40 years after her mind died.
Well, you know, Phyllis Schlafly, who some people actually credit with single-handedly mounting enough opposition to the Equal Rights Amendment that it fell short. This is the last time there was any attempt to actually amend the Constitution of the United States. There were 35 of the 38 required states. by 1978-79, and then five of those states ended up rescinding. There was a congressional resolution passed to extend it another 5 years, but they never reached that. And she, you know, said that the Equal Rights Amendment would end the traditional family as we know it. And traditional family is one of those code words, right? And, you know, Phyllis Schlafly is gone. And she was an icon of that conservative movement that came out of the wake of Barry Goldwater. That was, I mean, really, if you can imagine, like the power couple of conservatism, that would be Ronald Reagan and Phyllis Schlafly. Phyllis Schlafly, who is basically Anita Bryant without the charm and the orange juice. And, you know, Anita, speaking of Anita Bryant, wouldn't she be a candidate to sing a potential new national anthem? I had a couple in mind, considering where the economy is, and you had Frank Sinatra going. I was thinking Luck Be a Lady Tonight could be one. you know, there's a great song by AC/DC you may not be familiar with. Highway to Hell would work. But, you know, really the one that would really update.
Oh, the one from Cabaret.
Yeah, money. Well, I think ultimately the one that works, because you want to update it for the kids, you want to get the kids involved, it would be Britney Spears' Oops, I Did It Again. You know, it's funny you were mentioning labor, and this is Labor Day, and it's on my mind, and it has been on my mind a lot, because I find economics to be fascinating, and I find the fact that our, you know, you mentioned that Labor Day doesn't hold – really doesn't retain any of the meaning that was invested in Labor Day when in the first half of the 20th century, when labor was actually something very, very important and very, very meaningful. And in the absence of labor, the Great Depression, the rebooting of the American labor market after World War II, created in no small part because of the organizing power of labor, a massive middle class.
Well, you know, I'll get back to that in a second. You know what is missing that existed when labor was big? Is pride in work.
Well, sure.
Where do you see pride in work today? I mean, even if you're a computer genius, how much pride do you take in punching buttons unless it's somebody like you who can create wonderful words and ideas with that, you know?
Well, here's the thing, John. I think it's actually, oddly enough, it is coming back. There are a couple things. One's called the maker movement, and these are young people who are interested in craftsmanship. And I think one of the reasons why craftsmanship is coming back, it's coming back as a hobby or as a part of your personality, an expression of your personality. Because what's happened in the last 25 to 30 years is that manufacturing has moved away from craftsmanship to the kind of uber mass production and paradigm that we've seen shipped over to China to create plastic junk that we can buy on credit cards here. And ultimately, I think what's happened is that the value of labor is dissipating because labor itself is dissipating. You know, I have to laugh every time I hear Donald Trump say we're going to bring the jobs back. He hasn't actually been paying attention that the jobs he wants to bring back from China is already turning over to robots. And the automation of China is one of the great unreported stories. Now, unreported generally in the business press, it's reported because China wants to be the world's leader in robotics by 2020. And guess what? They're going to hit their target by the end of 2017. And there is a massive shift happening in the way work gets done. And I could tell you when 3D printing happens and you can have Amazon basically have localized kiosks with 3D printers and drones. And if you go and order something on Amazon and it's an item, they can 3D print it about 3 miles from you, have a drone pick it up from the 3D printer and drop it off on your doorstep. What is going to happen to labor when that's the economic paradigm?
You know what kind of barter system we have today? We buy plastic with plastic.
Yeah. Well,
In 1970, I had Buckminster Fuller on for an hour on my show, and he said, what Americans and what people on Earth are going to have to learn to do is they're going to have to learn to live without working, because there will come a time in the next decades when jobs won't be around, But you'll have food, you'll have a place to live. You're going to have to learn how to survive without actually working.
Well, and what I think may happen, because I think Buck Mr. Fuller is right, and who, I mean, boy, that's so big of me to say, you know, Buck Mr. Fuller was right. I mean, wow, what a great mind I am to come up with that. But I think what that may do is actually reboot craftsmanship, because all of the basic necessities are going to be easily produced through an automated production chain. But things like an incredibly well-made picture frame or an umbrella or a craft beer or a certain type of food that takes a lot of labor and a lot of time, those things will actually regain value, because those will be the few things that have value in an environment in which everything else is plastic junk.
Well, you know, I'm sure it's like the students that Rebecca talked about. I think there somehow is an underground in America of which Americans are not aware of, unless they're just in their small little alcoves and their small little groups doing these things that you're talking about. But I have a feeling it's massive. I mean, people getting into organic farming, people getting into crafts. You never hear about it, but it exists. And these were the people that Bernie Sanders unknowingly tapped and deserted.
No, I absolutely agree. And it's something that has been satirized in terms of, like, Portland, which is seen as one of these places where you can get artisanal pickles and artisanal ice cubes. You know, people who spend six hours making the perfect ice cube. And we can sort of laugh at that, but on a grander scale, there are these makers fairs popping up all around the country where people come together and they bring things that they've created themselves and they exchange ideas. In a sense, you know, there's this thing that's been going on. It's become something of an oddity now, because you have these jet setters that go into Burning Man in the Nevada desert now, and they have these air-conditioned camps, and then they go as tourists. But this is – Burning Man was kind of a forerunner of that, of people who come together from the sort of the outliers of society. It's sort of an anti-consumer idea where you're building things and you're creating things out of whole cloth or out of wrought iron, as the case may be. I think an opportunity. I think, unfortunately, when I see the political situation and the political paradigm, you know, what we're being offered is not a vision of a transition to a future in that Buckminster Fuller is talking about, but I see clinging on to a past that's already going away. And that's kind of a dangerous paradigm, because what it does is it heightens grievance. And if there's anything we can say about Trump supporters, whenever I hear them yelling at a rally, you know, USA, USA, it sounds to me like the death rattle of a way of life, because these are generally high school educated, working class white males, and their way of life is actually disappearing.
Well, it is. And when you look at the campaign between Hillary and Donald, it's like you're looking at strangers running to be president of a land of which you're not familiar, that you're not a part of. And how do you think this is going to play out?
John, it's befuddling. I will say this. If Joe Biden was the Democratic nominee, he would be up 20 points.
That's true.
I mean, it would not even be close. And the only reason Trump has any shot
let me tell you something. None of the above would be up 20 points.
Well, right. And this is this really is the oddity of the election, is that the only way Trump can win is by running against Hillary Clinton, and the only way Hillary Clinton can win is by running against Donald Trump. So we're not – it's hard to figure how it's going to play out. It's almost like the last person who makes the last mistake is going to come in as a loser. I do think this, though, John, that the winner of the election, in other words, the winner of the White House, is going to be the loser of the election. Because the party that loses the White House is going to be poised to raise huge amounts of money opposing the person who wins the White House.
You know what? I would be I'd be inclined to disagree with that, because I think if Hillary Clinton wins, the establishment, the Pentagon, media are going to be absolutely thrilled, because she represents them. Donald Trump does not represent them. And is it true? I've gotten two or three emails from people saying that you always talked about if NAFTA were repealed, that you'd vote for the person who would repeal it. And they tell me that Donald Trump has said publicly he would repeal NAFTA. I've never heard that.
Well, yes. I mean, that's part of his anti-trade agenda, his anti-global trade agenda. You know, NAFTA is going to have to be – now I think he's saying it needs to be reworked. But, you know, it's going to be very, very difficult for him to do things like repealing NAFTA. He's going to have to get people on board politically. But I do think this – there is going to be a lot of money raised one way or another against the candidate who wins. And it's going to – you know – yes, he does not represent the military-industrial complex per se, but you know what? He can be contained, and he can be contained by them. He can be controlled. And in Congress, that's where the money is spent on weapon systems, and that's what really matters for the military-industrial complex.
On September 5th, 1980, when I spent 3 hours interviewing Jim Garrison, before I left, I asked him this question: do you think the president runs a country? And it's interesting, he's on camera and he's drinking a glass of water when I ask him, and he spits out the water. It's a very funny sight. And he says, well, John, I did before they killed John Kennedy.
All right.
And he had a wonderful Shakespearean way of expressing himself. I can't recreate it because I can't speak like that, but he talked about the fact that the gunshots from Dealey Plaza echoed down through history, and they all heard them. Every president heard those shots, and every president knows that's what's in store for him if he doesn't follow the orders, because no president runs the country. And he said, John, it's Germany in 1933. And he said that on September 5th, 1980. And, you know, no president. It's like Jimmy Carter, when there was an attempt on Jimmy Carter's. He tried to get Ted Sorensen to be head of the CIA.
Yeah, good luck with that.
Yeah, well, they didn't want a Kennedy man, because Kennedy said he was going to blow them into 1,000 pieces. So they chose Stanfield.
Turner. And even Stanfield Turner, who was a Navy guy, it was called a massacre by people inside the CIA. He fired like 100 covert agents, and most of those guys ended up populating Herbert Walker Bush's political campaign in 1979-1980.
Yeah, and the thing is that
about 30 seconds or less.
Oh my gosh, you're kidding. Well, we're out of time. Oh, I wanted to tell you the story about the dancers we're talking about. Eleanor Power, Ginger. We'll have to do it next time.
But John, I just want everybody to know, he is working on what is going to be a gangbusters film. You've got to go to his Facebook page. There's a link there. Support the film. Anything that you can do to support it would be great. This thing is going to – I'm just telling you, I know a little bit about what's going on with it. It's going to be amazing. Hang on to your seats. Buckle your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy ride.
Oh, Betty Davis couldn't have said it better. Okay, where can they hear you and where can they read you?
Well, just go to newsvandal.com. It's spelled like it sounds, News Vandal, and you can sign up for the rundown. Unfortunately, it doesn't look like I'm going to be on the Acelli Effect for the time being, because that's been put on hold. But I will be on Crew FM, KRUU-FM, every Friday at 2:30 for the week that was. And, of course, John, be back here again with you in 2 weeks. Looking forward to it.
Oh, thanks so much, Joe. I am, too. You have a wonderful holiday the rest of the day. We'll see you in 2 weeks. We'll talk to you in I'll talk to you before then. And everybody, thank you so much. Good night and good luck.
You're my spark of nature's fire. You're my sweet, complete desire. A sunny, 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 sunny. I love you.